Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 20th, 2019, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Scribes, I Want to Break Free from the EMR. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Katie Walker. She is an emergency physician in Melbourne, Australia. She's a clinical researcher at the Cabarini Hospital and an adjunct clinical associate professor at Monash University. Welcome to the SGEM, Katie.
Thanks, Ken. It's really great to be on Skeptics.
Well, we are recording this over Skype, and it's already March 21st where you are. Does that mean you're from the future?
Yeah, great question. I'm still trying to explain time zones to my kids. Haven't got there yet.
Well, we had originally talked about recording this at SMAC next week in Sydney. Oh, I am so looking forward to SMAC. But unfortunately, it just wasn't going to work out.
Yeah, sorry, Ken. I can't make it to SMAC this time. But I hope that you have a great conference and you enjoy your trip. And if you get any downtime, I'd strongly recommend getting on a ferry and going for a ride around Sydney Harbour and maybe getting out for a stop or two and walking around the edge of the harbour in the bush. It's absolutely stunning on a beautiful day.
Well, my wife and I are leaving tomorrow morning, and we are so looking forward to the trip. But can you give us a case?
Yeah, look, I'd love to. And I think that everybody will be familiar with this sort of scenario. So your emergency department is backing up. You've got ambulances ramping and patients queuing at triage. Your medical team is great, but you notice that the busier all of you become, the more you see your docs at their computers rather than at patient bedsides. You're frustrated that whilst you frantically fill in data in the electronic medical record from your last consultation, your neighbour's in your waiting room with a dislocated shoulder and you haven't been able to get to her yet. Surely there's a better way of working than this.
Well, 1 in 10 health, high-income countries' consultations are now in emergency medicine. Most emergency physicians use some form of electronic medical record, or EMRs, when seeing patients.
So you'll all have noticed that the EMR tasks we undertake are expanding rapidly, far beyond simply documenting the history and physical exam. And every implementation slows us down.
Well, there was a study by Hill et al. Demonstrating that an ER shift can have not 1,000, not 2,000, not 3, but
4,000 clicks.
And physicians are spending more time on EMRs than any other activity, including direct patient care. The SGEM number 159 looked at the implementation of an EMR in a tertiary care ED. Median wait times, length of stay, left without being seen, and length of stay for admitted patients all got worse, with adding computerization physician order entry, or CPOE, as part of their EMR.
Yeah, so for me, and I think everyone else are beginning to realize that the implementation of the EMR into clinical practice represents a very large global medical productivity loss. Could also have a negative impact on patient care.
There are studies showing that EMRs are one of the biggest causes, if not the number one cause, of physician burnout. Physicians suffering from burnout provide a lower quality of care and safety of care. This means there is an association between EMRs and worse patient care.
So if we have to use EMRs, how can we improve our productivity? There haven't been any large, independent, multi-center, randomized evaluations of scribe effectiveness and safety until now.
Katie, we better define scribes. These are individuals who help physicians by doing the clerical tasks. And there is a long list of things that they can do, including documentation of the clinical encounter, information retrieval, and discharge preparation.
So we know from previous work that most physicians, that's 85%, prefer working with scribes. And most patients tolerate scribes being involved in the clinical encounter. While they've been working in US departments for years, they're only now beginning to be used in Canada and Australia.
So what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's podcast?
What's the impact of scribes on emergency medicine physicians' productivity and patient throughput?
And the reference?
The impact of scribes on emergency medicine doctors' productivity and patient throughput, a multi-center randomized trial that's been published in the BMJ in January 2019.
And you failed to mention who the lead author on this study was.
Oh, that was me.
That's right. We have the lead author on today. All right, let's go through the PICO. What was the population?
So we evaluated scribes in five Australian emergency departments.
And what was the intervention?
We used the same physicians and we measured their productivity and patient flow with and without scribes.
And so what you did is sometimes you'd have scribes and that was the intervention, and you'd compare it to the times where the physicians didn't have scribes. What was the primary outcome?
That's exactly right. So our primary outcome was the total patients per physician per hour, so physician productivity, which includes time that they spend at medical triage and handover patients, where another doc undertakes the primary or main consultation.
And there were a number of secondary outcomes, and I'll list those in the show notes. I think you should read the author's conclusions, since they're yours.
Sure. So scribes improved emergency physician productivity, particularly during primary consultations, so that's the main consultation, and they decreased patients' length of stay. Further work should evaluate the role in the scribe in countries with health systems similar to Australia's.
All right, let's run through the quality checklist for randomized clinical trials. The study population included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Yes.
Did you adequately randomize your patients?
We adequately randomized the physicians, yes.
Oh, yes. They weren't patients. They were physicians. And the randomization process, was it concealed?
Yes, with a caveat. Australian HR law requires that you publish shift allocations a fortnight before people work them. But the scribes and physicians were unable to see each other's rosters.
Now, there may be some people who listen to the SGEM who don't know what a fortnight is. Could you define a fortnight for our listeners?
Yeah, an American reviewer on the BMJ paper said that too. I'm sorry. A fortnight is 2 weeks, 14 days.
There we go. It's two Constantine units because one Constantine unit is 7 days after Emperor Constantine codified that a week would be 7 days back in 321 AD. So you're talking about two Constantine units, one fortnight, or 2 weeks to the rest of us. All right, were the physicians analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes. So except when there was unanticipated physician shift leave. So we took the stance that if an alternative suitable physician could be identified, so someone else in the trial, the scribe worked a shift with the alternate, and the shift was counted as scribe. If the scribe went home, they couldn't find anyone to work with, then there were no patients to count. So this can be talked about in terms of intention to allocate. So a small percentage of scribes were reallocated at the start of the shifts, and this is in the consort statement in the paper. And all patients who were seen by a physician were counted as scribed, whether or not the scribe was in the room during that time. So if the scribe was on the phone trying to find an angiogram result for a patient and the physician picked up someone else in the meantime and went in and did their own consult, took their own notes, it was still allocated into the scribed group. So by intention to treat, yes, they were analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized.
Well, it's getting a little messy because we have physicians and we have patients. So question five is, did the study patients, were they recruited consecutively? In other words, did you have any selection bias when looking at the patient encounters?
Well, there would have been two types of potentials for selection bias. Patients could decline to have a scribe and physicians could exclude a patient at their discretion. But actually, they never did that. And we know that the physicians, we haven't reported this academically, but we know the physicians decline the scribe about 1 in 1,000 patients. A patient's never seemed to decline the scribes. But also, if the physician felt that they had the ability in the midst of their world of multitasking and everybody needing them, that they could actually pick up a patient because the scribe was there, then they may well have done that. If they felt that there's no way they had capacity to walk in, see the patient, walk out, write notes, they might not pick them up. But if the scribe was there, they might make an alternate decision and see more. Also importantly, we excluded scribes from night shifts and public holidays to try and contain the research budget. We only had a fixed amount of money to pay our scribes during the project.
The whole practicality of doing research. It costs money, and paying people more for nights and holidays would obviously impact on the budget, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we couldn't afford to run out of money and stop the trial early. We had to be fiscally responsible with the study.
Well, you know, there's always, you know, some kind of give and take and limitations to studies. So if you had stopped the trial early, we would have pointed that out as stopping the trial early. And if you had done it this way, where you weren't having scribes working overnight or on public holidays, we'll have something about that in the nerdy section.
Yeah.
The sixth question, the patients in both groups were similar with respect to prognostic factors.
Very clearly, when we analyzed the two groups, they were identical.
Now, was everybody unaware of group allocation?
No, it wouldn't have been possible to blind patients or clinicians to the presence of a scribe. It may have been possible to blind the outcome assessors, and we didn't do that.
Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention of the scribe?
Yes.
Was the follow-up complete?
Yes, we had 100% of data available for analysis.
And were all patient-important outcomes considered?
Well, we believe so. This was the final study of 8 papers, all of which have been published, evaluating different aspects of the same intervention, the scribe. So patient experience, physician experience, documentation, quality, cost of training, they've all been published and are linked to this paper should you wish to read them.
So while in this particular study it may not be self-contained that you've considered all patient important outcomes, they have been considered, just published in different studies. Is that correct?
That's correct. In the same population and the same time period.
The 11th and final question, the treatment or economic effect was large enough and precise enough to be clinically or economically significant?
We think it is, but it would be open to interpretation. What we've been very careful to do in our cost-benefit analysis is explain that not all sites get the same outcomes from the same scribes, and that you should analyze it very carefully for the performance and the turnaround times and flow and so forth for yourself and create your own analysis. And we've given you a toolkit in the appendix for how to do the maths to work out your own business case.
Okay, that concludes the 11 quality checklists for randomized control trials. Let's run through the key results. There were 12 scribes and 88 physicians working at 5 sites in these Australian hospitals. They were compared to almost 600 scribe shifts to just over 3,200 non-scribed shifts. So this included about 5,100 scribed consultations and 24,000 non-scribed consultations. What was the key result you found?
Total patients seen per hour increased with scribes.
Okay, we can give people a little bit more detail. So without a scribe, physicians were seeing 1.13 patients per hour.
With a scribe, 1.31 patients per hour.
Okay, and so that's an absolute increase of 0.18 more patients per hour.
Yeah, which is a relative increase of 15.9%.
So almost 16% relative increase in throughput. All right, there were a number of secondary outcomes, which we did list in the show notes, but I wanted to highlight a few key ones.
So primary consultations, that's where you do the, we haven't necessarily properly explained that, that's where you do the history and physical order tests, get them back, interpret them, write the medication chart, and undertake disposition. That we've classed as a primary consultation. So primary consultations per hour increased from 0.83 to 1.04 patients per hour, which is a 25.6% gain.
And there was a minor patient safety event reported for 1 out of 300 consultations, events mainly related to the wrong patient selection in the EMR. Half of the events reported involved the scribe identifying a problem in someone else's patient and intervening to prevent harm.
So the cost analysis was in favor of employing scribes, given the productivity and throughput gains.
Well, that completes the results sections. Let's talk nerdy. And I'm going to give the first of the 5 points. The first one is about selection bias, and scribes were not used at the discretion of the physicians or if the patients declined. The number of times patients declined a scribe was not recorded. This could have introduced selection bias, but I think you've already mentioned how many times patients declined having a scribe.
Yeah, that's right. Almost never. And the physician declining a scribe to, or a particular scribe into a specific consult was very rare, usually related to sensitive consultations or where you wouldn't want to disturb the patient. So if you happen to have a near pediatric respiratory arrest, then and you want to remove providers from the room and only have the doc and the nurse in there, that's a sort of situation where you wouldn't want to take a scribe in.
And we've already mentioned that you would have blown your budget if you had scribes present at night or on public holidays. This also could have introduced some selection bias and could limit the validity to other shifts.
I completely agree. There is no data on those sort of shifts, but the economic, the business case for the scribe, if you work in an environment where you get paid more for antisocial shifts, then the likelihood is the scribe will get paid a bit more and the physician will get paid a lot more, making that the place to put the scribes as your first choice if you're in operations, just not in research on a research budget.
Okay. How about you give point number two?
Yeah, look, I'd love to. So scribe research is hard, and lack of blinding is one of the academic hurdles for scribe research. So for complex intervention evaluations, you can't always make the perfect study. If you haven't blinded the physician, patient, and scribe to the intervention, then you can introduce a Hawthorne effect, which means that people might behave differently in the presence of a scribe or if they know that they're being observed. So there are issues with measuring the intervention that don't get properly incorporated into studies. Examples in scribe research are that your physicians, my experience of my physician group is that people work as hard as they possibly can during the clinical shift. That may mean that they batch all their notes, and when they have a scribe, they go home. When they do their handover, then they go home, they leave. When they don't have a scribe, they undertake unrecorded and unrostered overtime, and they stay behind writing all their notes for the patients that they could afford to leave until later. So that is not going to be measured in this sort of study. The second thing we found is that some of our sites manned their OBS ward with interns and had an overall supervising consultant emergency physician. And when the scribes were used for accompanying the physician that had the OBS ward duties, then the interns were redundant, essentially. So rather than sitting there and doing nothing, they went and picked up new patients in the main part of the ER for the whole of the shift. And we didn't measure any of the intern patient increases. And finally, any rigorous study protocol can be upset by simple day-to-day ED operations glitches, like last-minute sick leave of both the scribe and the physician. So no scribe study is going to be academically perfect. We hope pragmatic studies like this will better resemble the real-life working environments of our EDs.
The third nerdy point we wanted to bring up was about the payment models. Some jurisdictions may, or may not, find that per-patient billing or revenue increase when a scribe is present. This wasn't measured in the study, but may, or may not, provide a stronger economic argument for scribes in some settings. It'll all depend. A lower volume community ED, not using CPOE, a scribe would make little sense. However, in a high volume setting that is using CPOE and paid on productivity, it might make great sense to have a scribe on the shift.
So if we move to point four, I want to talk about external validity. So more work should be undertaken in several areas regarding scribes. Similar studies should be considered in settings outside of Australia, such as the US, Canada, the UK, and European countries. As clinicians, we should advocate for ourselves and our patients and partner with IT designers to make EMRs that work for us and for our patients. We should also rigorously explore the scribe role in alternate settings, such as clinics, offices, and inpatient wards.
All right, we made it to number five. And the fifth nerdy point is Band-Aid. While we would all like our information technology systems to be better, designed and integrated, able to reduce duplication, or give us improved functionality, the scribe role could provide an immediate, even if temporary, fix. Until IT research is able to demonstrate productivity gains with a similar cost profile, we should offload our clerical tasks in a safe way and return to our core medical roles, information synthesis and communication. In other words, let us break free from being expensive data entry clerks and allow doctors to be doctors. Well, that's it for the five nerdy points. Is there anything else you want to say before leaving this section?
No, I'm all good. Thanks, Ken.
Okay. I'm going to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions. So we generally agree with you, Katie.
Good. Yeah, you try very hard to present a balanced view in the papers. So the SGEM bottom line, scribes could have a positive impact on productivity and patient throughput, depending on your practice environment.
And can you give us a case resolution?
Love to. So you decide to implement a scribe program at your hospital. The IT and processes still remain tedious, but you've offloaded many of them. You rediscover what it's like to be a physician who's enabled to walk from one room to another, seeing patients, providing high-quality, evidence-based care, and moving rapidly to where you're needed. You go home less tired despite a bigger patient load.
Oh, my chest was swelling. I think my heart grew 2 times just during that paragraph. Yes, I get to go back and start seeing patients and provide high-quality, evidence-based care. In other words, what I love to do. How about the clinical application?
So when you're working with a scribe, enjoy your work. Get used to being enabled to see more patients whilst feeling like you've done less. Also, the note of caution from our patient safety events work in this paper. It's really important that you enable your scribe to speak up if they see anything untoward happening in the department. They're an intelligent observer, and they may be the only one to notice something. Secondly, check every time you open the EMR that you or the scribe have selected the correct patient.
So what are you going to tell the patient when you go into the room and you've got someone following you?
This is John. He's my scribe today. His job is to organize everything you need and write all my instructions into the computer for the emergency team. This will help me focus on being your physician.
All right, it's time for the Keener contest. And last week's winner was... There wasn't one. I guess Chip picked too hard of a question. Well, the answer to last week's Keener question was... The earliest published article describing ultrasound confirmation of endotracheal tube placement was by Raphael and Connard. Ultrasound confirmation of endotracheal tube placement, Journal of Clinical Ultrasound in September of 1987. Oh, it was from the 80s. I love it. All right, what's the question this week?
Gee, Ken, that was a tough one. Okay, today we've got a nerdy computer question this week. What's the Turing test?
Oh, that is uber nerdy, and it'll bring back memories of going to see the movie Blade Runner. All right, so if you know the answer, send an email to the sgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, there is some other FOMED on this issue, and I'll list those in the show notes. But thank you, Katie, for coming on the show and talking about your scribe study.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Ken. Thanks for giving the opportunity to talk about the scribe work.
Well, now you get to give the SGEM tagline in your thickest Australian accent.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.